Command CEO Ryan Zumwalt.
For the Dallas assistant on there, we have between us, Yurok Group, there's roughly from partnerships pull of data is somewhere around 60 members. We will start small. We're starting with the Hoopa tribal members only because it is a cost. Every time we wind up having to do a spin on someone, that is a cost directly to Kamau and to Hoopa on there. As we look, if we have capacity, maybe we look at our neighbors and decide we want to grow that way. We're building the design right now is for a 8-chair den. Now, what Marceline talked about is the tribe south of us. The tribe south of us built a dialysis center, an actual what you would see when you go to the coast for DaVita, Fresenius, and McKinleyville. Now, remember, dialysis centers are walking ambulatory centers. There's not always a nurse there. They're usually techs on that. And then the techs run the machines on there. From Dr. Matthews did his survey of our members, and what he looked at is saying that these are the members that can go up there. They're stable. They're early in their dialysis. The average person on dialysis is about a 15-year life cycle, typically. They're early in. They're stable. They just don't have the home environment to manage doing dialysis, meaning temperature-controlled cleanliness. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just it requires an infrastructure. All we're doing is providing that space. They'll come there. Their equipment is theirs. We house their equipment. We hook them up. We run them within that space on there. Now, the cost with what we were waiting on is meeting with Beverly Miller, who's a regional over IHS. She has emergency funds. I spoke with her one-on-one multiple times through the summer when Councilman Jackson and I and the team were down there. She said she would give us emergency funds. We just have to find the emergency. Sarnoline Group let me know early on that they were potentially closing one of their buildings. Now with this building closing, that is an emergency because it's going to compress our members. So I don't know where they're going to ship them to. Are they going to absorb them in Eureka? Or does this mean our members now have to go to Crescent City? I'm not sure. But it has created an emergency. So I've moved that email and I'm drafting a letter to go to IHS for Bev to absorb that or to be able to request that $2.4 million of startup funds to get us going. Now, and that's only to support the contract cost on there for Sonderling Group and them to supply equipment, docks, all that type of stuff. For us to start the dialysis den, the proposal from Harley, from our project manager, is about $300,000 plus or give or a little bit past to actually remodel that section. We can slim it down to about $250,000 if we just remodel the inside for right now, and we can save the outside till summer. That is where we're at currently with the board is that decision. Do we want to spend that money? Because that's going to come out of us. We met with IHS on the 13th, and Harley presented this with the board, as IHS said that they won't pay for that remodel under the pretense of what it is now. When we flip it to the Dallas's Den and it goes under 105L, then we can recoup that money, but it's on there under 105L in depreciation, but it's going to be 8 to 10 years before we break even with our investment up front in that. So that's where we're at. It's just all we have to do is decide. It sounds like with council, if we're moving forward, I'm game. We can start to just need the board motion to be able to spend that money, and we can start the remodel, and we can bring that up on the next board meeting.
Councilman Ryan Jackson.
I have a question for Ryan.
Yes, sir.
So an individual who has in-home dialysis right now, their costs are paid for, I'm assuming, at some point, either through partnership or PRC or whatever the case might be. So if all we're doing is transferring somebody from an in-home dialysis setting that would have already all been 100% paid for into a setting that's there at the tribal clinic, what additional costs are there that are going to be so through the roof? I understand a complete dialysis center in the millions. That's not what we had talked about, but trying to understand it.
Yep. So to answer that question, as and answer Marceline's question for safety, So we talk about safety. This is a new program to us. So Sonderling has set up this program in three different other tribes. I've set up dialysis programs elsewhere outside of here. It's nice in the beginning that you have that oversight of physicians. So part of that large front cost is telemedicine physicians, having the physicians be up here to ensure that our team is doing adequate care and the right type of care while we're starting this. So the whole pretense of the plan on this one, the long-term plan, is to have Sonderling group for 2 to 3 years, and then we phase them out. We need them and their footprint, their policies, everything to get us up and started quickly, and that infrastructure that they have with the oversight of the physicians to make sure we're doing good care, adequate care to our members. So if there's something that goes wrong, let's say a member gets put on dialysis and their blood pressure drops, we have instant access to a doc that specializes in it. Because your PCPs, our general docs, they're great, but when you're dealing with someone on dialysis, you can't just come in and give them a liter of fluid to get their blood pressure back up. You'll cause a whole lot more ripple effect from there on that, where a nephrologist may look at giving them something else, some albumin, something that's going to kick them along, but not give them the expansion of a ton of fluid. And that's the aspect that we're paying for up front. And that's what I've asked for Bev Miller to cover for at least 2 years.
Okay, so then the individual who's at home on the in-home dialysis, don't they face the same issues of blood pressure and all these other without the...
Correct. They do. Okay. Actually, many people that are in those dialysis centers can do dialysis at home. If you look at Bernie, back in 2010, 2012, started issuing out their small portable, hemodialysis units to go home, very similar to peritoneal dialysis. You run it overnight. But again, it goes back into, it's just our members have to have that environment that's clean, temperature controlled, has everything that they need to be able to operate safely within there. So that member that I'm aware of that you're discussing on, their family member built out a section in their home for them that's special for that, that maintains the temperature, meets all those small requirements for them to safely do their dialysis.
Vivina Orchid.
Thanks for the thorough overview that you've done. I've never met you, but thank you. But can you tell me the year that it happened and some short summary of exactly what that loan is about or where it took from or why they dipped from another program?
That was $3.3 million. It happened, I want to say, it was four? Oh, yep. Happened late fall this year. The motion was on a Friday. We wound up looking to come in. We worked with council. Housing was short for finishing one of their projects, and then this is where we're at. Oh, sorry. Manz, did you say April? 24. Sorry, 24.
Prior council.
Sorry, prior council made that end of decision. We put up the money. We do have an agreement with housing. They were supposed to get their first grant, and they checked with the grant. They were supposed to get the first grant somewhere around June, and they were going to fund that back to us. It was a pretty sizable chunk, like 1.3, 1.8. I believe that grant finally came in December. Their second grant was supposed to come in December. Don't believe they've heard yet whether that was awarded or not. And that would have really substantiated a significant portion. I think they would have been down to around 200 something thousand that over 20 years that they'd have to repay. However, right now we're looking at that 1.3 that came in December that we will need very soon.
Sally Slater.
So when did we become a tribe of loaning department shortfalls?
When did that come about that we became a loaning department to loan other entities money? Because Gamow, we seem like we don't get enough care as it is, and we're loaning money out. But what I was going to talk about really quickly, I want to talk about the diabetes program. Before we even get to dialysis, we have a prevention. You're supposed to have a prevention. Well, I've been a diabetic, and I think they only reach out to you when they want to. There's a diabetic department, which to me, as a tribal member, is non-existent. There used to be newsletters that used to inform you about meals and different things they used to have available. That is non-existent when you go over there. And you talk about your referral department. What referral department? My sister had to wait 8 months to get her leg things for her legs. And so these are the concerns we have. And as employees over there, I'm afraid to go there because if I say boo to somebody, I get 86 or something from their talking, you know, and it seems like it's about patient care. I go there and I'm sick. I'm not there to make their day. I'm there to get better. So if I say something and offend somebody, I'm in trouble. And I hope you guys fix that policy of making sure it works for the people, not against the people, not against the, that's my clinic. This is my tribe. And so when I go there, you're the CEO, and I've gone to you. I and my sisters have gone to you about these concerns, about dental. We're not getting the care that we need there. You know, we're PRC, you know, and then like the diabetes program. And we've gone to you last April, and, you know, I don't know if things got done with the PRC regarding my sister's for her braces for her leg. Now she's been waiting 16 months to try to get in for the, what is that called, physical therapy because of PRC. So I'm just saying that, you know, if you're not sitting there in front of people, you fall through the cracks. And your diabetes program is not in existence at this point, as for me.
Yep. Thanks, Alan.
Councilman Ryan Jackson.
Did you want to touch on the $3.3 million? I can just talk about it briefly. I was the interim chairman for a period of time, and the housing department came to the council and said that they're having trouble meeting the $3.3 million requirement to be able to complete the Elder Village that's over there currently. And at some point along the way, previous councils, I guess, had maybe promised some money from the ARPA, the COVID monies that were supposed to go to support the elder homes. Wherever that went, I'm not sure. We just didn't have it at the time when the request came in. So we had worked with the fiscal department to identify, you know, where we could actually take some of the money from, or you know, is either lose the elder home project entirely or figure out where we were going to come up with the $3.3 million. And none of the options were very good, and there were multiple options that were considered. Ultimately, the tribal council chose to take the money from the medical center with the promise that it would be paid back. It hasn't been paid back entirely yet. Still working through trying to make sure that does happen. I know that the medical center has been working with housing to try to figure out ways that they can become more present and available for the elders who are going to be there at the program, maybe access some billing opportunities that may come with, you know, regular visits, things of that nature. So that's just kind of in a nutshell the decision that was, or the council was required to make some kind of a choice. It was either the elder village go completely away and just have frames or foundations sitting over there, or take the money from somewhere. And ultimately, the medical center had the revenue necessary for us to be able to make that decision.
What is the management on housing part falls short, or was there an emergency situation to how they got short? Yeah, I mean, this is all information that should be all the time to the membership and should be reported to district meetings. So now I'm just not hearing about this. It's like, what? We're loaning our healthcare money?
Yeah.
That's what I'm concerned about.
Councilperson Darcy Miller.
Okay. So I was on the council when we did set the money aside, when the first project came to the tribe. And we said, well, we have to, we had to meet the obligation. So we had to have some money set aside for that. And Ryan is correct. When the housing authority came to get the money from the tribe, the money was no longer there. So they had to do something, and that's what they did. In addition to that, the housing, the elder project also included Gamal in there because they're going to have a facility in there where that Gamal could go in there and assist the elders that are living in that unit there. So, and they tried to work with Gamal on some of those things. I want to get back to the dialysis. I am in support of the dialysis den right now for servicing the people that need it now. But I'm also, like with Ryan, we need to work on prevention. You know, what is causing our people to have to get on dialysis? If they're pre-diabetic or if they're a diabetic and they're taking medication, I'm just going to use metformin for an example. It's just an example. So if they're taking metformin and it's known that metformin is affecting their kidneys, why are we still dishing out metformin to our people that are on diabetics right now? You know, I mean, look, let's figure out why that's happening. And, you know, for the prevention portion of it, where's the statistics on who we are serving and why we're serving them?
And for metformin and discussing on that one, Councilwoman, it comes up to the lack of specialists. Our PCPs are great. They're trained. It's like being your general mechanic on there. They're trained to do exactly what they're doing on that. But as we build a dialysis den, it solicits and brings in experts to look at a larger picture, which allows us to really help to make a robust preventative program, because they're in our lap.
Doing that now. We're not trying to
prevent
people from being diabetics.
We are. And that's the direction we're going. I've engaged with partnership and engaged with Stanford as their pharmacy renal program. It just takes a minute to be able to pull them all up and be able to solidify that.
Vivina Orkin.
We're taking from here. We don't have any for dialysis, but we're prioritizing dialysis. Just kind of, I'm trying to figure out the trail here. Thank you.
Jordan Haley.
I would like to say real quick, when it does get open, I implore everyone to go over and check it out. The dialysis den housing and their crew has done an amazing job getting it together. It looks really, really great over there. On top of some of the new houses that have gone up in Campbellfield as well, we are starting to solve some of the housing issues. As we know, it's still a big looming issue. The lack of housing is a problem, but hopefully opening that up will allow some elders to move in there and open up their own homes. And I was over talking to Darcy the other day, and there's still available units. So anyone that's interested, go grab an application, fill it out. I mean, it's going to be a really, really nice place. Just FYI.
Glenna Moore, Hoopa Tribal Citizen. I just want to make a couple of comments. One on the dialysis, and I think, excuse me, some of you have heard me before, because I'm always concerned about the risk. The risk. So it sounds like there's going to be a special meeting for this. Or is there? There's going to be
we can do a community meeting.
A community meeting. I really asked for that community meeting just so that people know and we're informed. I've asked the council many times, please slow down and make sure that you're making decisions based on data and information. I know diabetes and dialysis, chronic kidney disease, these are heartfelt things, and a lot of times we make decisions through our heart and not necessarily through our thinking process. So I understand that. I worked in New Mexico for Indian Health Service lots of years ago at a small hospital. I was the chief dietitian there, and we did get a dialysis center, but people had to drive 85 miles, and we had 35 people at the time on dialysis, but it was right next to the hospital. Toyabe, I did hear from Ryan himself say that their dialysis center almost broke their clinic because of the cost. Also, Bishop, they have a small hospital there. Excuse me. It's a small critical care hospital, 25 bed. So if somebody's crashing, they can take them to the hospital. We're an hour away from the nearest hospital. These are my concerns. It's the concerns about the risk to the people and the risk to Kamau Medical Center. I'm not saying, no, we shouldn't have a dialysis center, but I would like to see us have that public forum so that people could be well-informed. And what does this mean? Because maybe your loved one isn't going to be a candidate for those that may already be on dialysis. Maybe they won't be a candidate. They're still going to be driving to dialysis. So I think we just need... we need that information. What's the difference between peritoneal and hemodialysis? Home dialysis, what does that mean? I think it'd be really good if we had these things defined so that people truly understand, because it is home heal. What is a, why is it called a dialysis den, which is normally or usually attached to a skilled nursing or a long-term care, limited to 8 beds. I don't know. You know more than me. But these are the things that I'm hoping that we can have answered. Where's the data? How many potential patients? I've looked at some of the data. I won't share that here, but I'm wondering how many of our patients come outpatients, because we should be looking at we shouldn't be looking at, oh, these are potential, we're going to feed our dialysis center, because you've got to keep feeding that dialysis center with failed kidneys. And so I agree with Ryan and some of you that are really concerned about prevention, because we really should be working to keep people's kidneys from failing. But it doesn't take away from the current need. So I hope that we get that forum so that we can really get our questions answered. And if the council's already made the resolution to move forward, but hopefully we'll get all of our answers answered. Thank you.
Thank you, Glenna. We're going to shift gears now. We still have tribal forestry and Hoopa Development Fund that need to present. We also wanted to hear from tribal fisheries as well. I'll go ahead and turn it over to Clarence Hostler, then we're going to go to Mike Orchid.
Well, I know we've absorbed a lot of information here today, so I'll try to be quick. Joe just asked me to say a few things about Hoopa Forestry, where we've been recently and kind of where we'll expect to go this year. We have a lot of exciting things to do this year. First of all, forestry is committed to getting our logs moving again this summer. We've got about 5 to 8 million board feet to move this summer. We have about that same amount planned to move down off of the hills next year. Another exciting thing that we're working on is working on developing some long-term agreements with the Bureau of Land Management to the west of us, also with the Forest Service to the east of us, to help them do some of their logging and provide other fuel reduction work on Forest Service lands within our ancestral lands. Those opportunities will help us generate economic activity, hopefully livable wage jobs for our folks and our tribal entities. Let's see what else. We also plan to do a lot of cultural burning, slash burning, fuel reduction work, fuel mastication work on Shasta Trinity National Forest to the south of us and the Forest Service. We have thousands of acres to brush on Forest Service land, as well as thousands of acres to brush on our own timberlands in Hoopa. So we have a lot of activity planned for the next year or two and into the even after that, even though the after that's less defined. Let's see. Yeah. In addition to that, there's a lot of support work that goes along with that, which is all the environmental documentation, the planning, the wildlife surveys, and the fuel burn plans, and coordination with the fire department to get this work done, all this work done, in coordination with Hoopa Forest Industries, and seeing how they can fit into benefiting as one of the tribal entities, benefiting from this work that we're doing. We're going to include them in on that. Recently, we were able to secure a few hundred thousand dollars or $250,000 for a retail metal building to help the mill store and sell lumber out of. So that'll help a little bit there. We're reaching out, finding some new markets for that wood. Hopefully that'll create stability with that smaller operation. Our forest management plan is a huge plan that hasn't been revised in a while, but we plan on tackling that as well this year. One of the primary purposes of the forest management plan is to define and identify what is our sustainable amount of trees that we, our lumber that we can cut each year. on average over the next several years. In the past, we've had a forest management plan that looks like at about 10 years. We're considering looking at the next 30 years, so we'll have some more stability built into the plan on our allowable cut and be able to count on that amount. So with the, you know, for example, in our short run, we can foresee about 5 to 8 million board feet being cut on Hoopa timberlands this year. It's the same next year. Hopefully, we'll be helping BLM cut some of their logs, which will be another about 3 or 4 million board feet, as well as with the Forest Service, another 3 or 4 million board feet. So we should be able to double our amount of logs that we're moving this year and next year. And then beyond that, it should be a little bit more. Part of the forest plan process involves us inventorying our trees that we have on the reservation. And we've just completed that, and I have some preliminary results in that. I don't have the specific numbers now, but it's very complicated as far as which trees do we have available to harvest. But in general, in really simplistic terms, about 50 or 60 years ago, a lot of timber harvest started in earnest on the reservation. And so now those clear-cut stands from 50 or 60 years ago are now 50 or 60 years old, and they're not quite, some of them aren't quite big enough to cut. They're not quite ripe. So we need to wait about 5 to 10 years on many of those stands, and we'll have thousands of acres to cut in 5 or 10 years from now. And so we're trying to bridge the time between now, where we're kind of looking at the last of our larger mature stands to cut trees from, and figuring out and you know how we spend our time and where we cut between now and about 10 years from now. We're doing some modeling to figure out how we're going to do that. I think it's feasible, even though I'm going to sort of sound the alarm that, you know, we're running out of large trees to cut and we need to transition to cutting smaller trees. It's not an impossible task for us to figure out the right scheduling to get that done and minimize the amount of disruption to our normal operations in Hoopa as far as logging activity in the woods and the important revenue that generates for the tribe. Cutting, transitioning to cutting second growth opposed to old growth will require the tribe and HFI and us to all kind of think differently, retool some of the HFI's equipment. We've talked to the council about that. We need some, you know, I'll keep it there. I won't go into details about the exact equipment needed, but I think it's all doable and within the next few years, especially if we get these boosts of economic opportunity on nearby neighboring federal lands. In terms of our recently acquired 10,000 acre piece called the Pine Creek Tract or the Hoopa Mountain property, right now, we did get a small grant with a couple $100,000 to develop a forest plan for that this coming year. But there is a carbon project that came with that land when we acquired it. So that'll sort of slow us down or not exactly prevent us from logging it commercially, but any kind of logging that we do out there eventually will have to be considered on how it'll affect our carbon project, because we're committed under these carbon project contracts to maintain a certain level of inventory there without reducing it below a certain amount. Otherwise, we pay penalties. Recently, I think the value of the carbon out there is right around, it fluctuates between $1 million and $3 million of value in carbon, depending on the current weekly market. I don't check it every week, but I'll look at it once every few months or so, and it's ranged in the last 8 months between about $1.5 million and $3 million. So I expect it to fluctuate up. I hope to develop this forest plan for out there. I'll recommend to the council to create some sort of endowment to cash in on some of those credits to bank and be able to use some of that future investment revenue for continuing managing that those state fee lands, because they're not currently, you know, it's not currently federal trust land, it's state fee land. And we're also needing to dive into, it's kind of out of my forte, but we need to figure out exactly what our management costs are there on these state fee lands, because it's quite a large piece of property. This year, our folks at Forestry have done a thorough review of the roads out there. They're in pretty good shape on that property, so we shouldn't have to invest a lot there. We did collect a little bit of grant money from the state of California to do some road work there. We have a plan going in place. Our Kevin Lane, our fuels officer at Forestry, is developing a grant proposal to do some fuel reduction work on that 10,000-acre piece. And we'll start, I hope that we get that grant and we would be able to start that work this next year.
Glenna Moore.
So did we get an extension on the forest management plan? Wasn't it due December 2025? I don't know, I'm asking.
Yeah, there's some confusion on when does our current forest management plan expire? And from what I can tell, it doesn't ever expire. It's kind of like, I use a bad analogy. I call it commodity cheese. It's it only goes bad when it's bad, right? It stays good for a long time. So it only expire when it's no longer good. So if there's some component in it that proves not to be true, like if we made some assumptions about the environment that changes drastically, then we might have to address that.
So last year, I think I attended one meeting where I think it was the former forestry management director. And there was a meeting in the Soctish room, and he had a timeline. And I think it was from that meeting I had heard that there was, you know, a deadline for the forest management plan. But there were supposed to be scheduled some community meetings so that we could have community input into this next. I don't know how if it never expires, but are we in the process of updating it? So is there going to be some upcoming community meetings so that we could have community input?
Yeah, I think on the thumb drive handout, I put in a schedule of the community meetings that will be held for the forest management plan. These didn't get printed out back there, but I did put a schedule. So I have I've got like five modules scheduled for the forest management plan. The first module is on March 20th to talk about this, the purpose and the need and the structure of the plan. And another one on April 23rd to talk about the goals and objectives. And I'll have five modules throughout the year to talk about the revisions to the forest management plan.
Thank you. I really think we do need a vision. Yeah. A new vision also that doesn't just include looking at our timber as merchandise or resources, economic, the value, because, you know, that's also our food forests. And, you know, just making sure that we have a chance to have some input and talk about what we see as the value of not just the timber for dollars. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry if I sort of misconstrued that and I had a heavy timber harvest bent on my synopsis, but yes, our forests have a lot more value to the Hoopa people than just the amount of logs that we can get out of there.
Vivina Orchid.
Whatever happened to the carbon credits and then part of the plan and also the old growth that we're not using? Has that ever been brought up again about the carbon credits in forestry?
I'm not sure if I understand your question, but we don't have a carbon project on Hoopa timberlands, as far as I know. We recently required a 10,000 acre piece of land, right? And that has a carbon that came with us with a carbon project on it, and those carbon credits we own. So we have not redeemed any of the credits so far. But we do have, I think we have a 100-year obligation to monitor the inventory of that, and it's quite complex. The contract on that's over 1,000 pages long. I have not read it all, but it's quite, in my opinion, takes quite a bit of investment each year to maintain the inventory to prove to the California Air Resources Board that we have the standing inventory and credits to be able to keep earning those carbon credits each year. So, yeah, it's quite involved, but it can have great potential. I think with with a new change in administration in California and at the federal level, the value of carbon credits will definitely go up, even though they've sank in the last 2 years. So, yeah.
Thank you, Clarence. Really appreciate everybody sticking around like you have. I mean, it shows how much you guys care. Before we turn it over to Mr. Orchid for the fisheries update, we'll go to you, and then we're going to draw one more ticket we have for the, I think it's the grocery store, $100 gift card, but go ahead there, Vivina. Okay. Can we bring the tickets forward?
The road inventory, it's been put in our capital road inventory because it hasn't been in the past, so hopefully they'll be added to our.
Okay. We'll make a note of that. You said you're talking about adding the roads that are out there on the 10,000 acre to the BIA inventory. I honestly think that the first step would be to put that land into trust. I could be wrong about that, but definitely we'll make a note, look into that. I honestly don't know.
Roberta Chavez.
I really like the idea. I know my cousin Heather Campbell applied for a job with the tribe and never got hired, and she does grants for Mikwik and Orleans. And I always wish that HFI would have like a nonprofit watershed where we can go after all these climate grants, hire people, you know, contract with our own tribe to do the burning, contract, you know, with our own people to do burning, to do, and then we would recover some of that indirect cost that we forego with the forestry projects because we're waiving it because they don't make that much money, you know, the people that are working there. Because we talked about this in 2019 and the things that led to the indirect costs. It will help cover it if we're bringing outside, instead of letting outside nonprofits write grants and compete against the tribe. If we develop our own nonprofit and contract out the burning, the cutting, the watershed, all those things, that would be great. Would probably be under DeNoto.
Yeah. Well, if Heather's still listening, I would encourage her to submit a proposal to my office because we're always looking for grant writers and we have money available for a pool of grant writers through planning. So that would be great. I'd be happy to take a look at that and at least make sure she's considered when we go to hire for specific grant projects.
That would be good, or have her set up a nonprofit and go after money because that's kind of what she does.
We need that, yeah.
Yeah. My other question was, on the CNRA, you know, it's Newsom's last year. So with the clawbacks through the feds, we've dumped a lot of money into tribes and to the state. So there's $9.2 million in CNRA for shovel-ready projects. They could do the Pine Creek project that we've always wanted to do. Maybe you guys can look into that. I think the application is up in April, but we should have it ready.
I think, Clarence, you've been tracking some of that. Is that correct? California Natural Resources Agency, Geneva Thompson, those emails that we've been passing back and forth. I know some of are we tracking some of the grant funds through the California Natural Resources Agency? Remember Geneva Thompson?
Yeah. Did you talk about grant fund opportunity?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's most. Are you talking about land back?
Yeah, it's for land and climate. Because I sit on I sit on the grant selection committee for the state, and I have not had to recuse myself because we don't apply for any grants, hardly, except for housing. They like Darcy and housing.
Well, Pam Matz is about the only tribal manager I don't see here today, so we'll have to ask her because I know we've been asking her to track some of that.
Their highest priority, they told us that they'd only be doing land back grants this year. That's it.
And climate.
Shovel ready, and that's it.
They are shovel ready. So if you guys have that Pine Creek project, and I know a big part of that is in that reorganization thing that I did for the land back, or for when Deb Holland was dropping this. Remember I did that paper on the tribe and that research? But it has each portion on that in that paper. It has Hoopa Mountain, it has the summit site, and it has the
content, so I could forward it to you. It has all the maps and the background and the information.
You're saying it's an identifies what land would be available to...
It would just kind of be a background and a blueprint to kind of start. But you should have that stuff to do the land back for Pine Creek. Just dig. Maybe have OTA do a dig in the
CC me. Yeah, there's always tracts of land that come available for sale in our ancestral territory, for sure.
What was my other... transportation and roads. We, through the NAC, this is public knowledge. I'm not saying anything that's not spoken about because you serve on the NAC now. Congratulations. But they contacted the tribe and they were going to wanted to do a pilot project on tribes that would sell gravel to Caltrans, and we never replied, so they're going with Covelo. I think they are eventually going to meet with Hoopla, but we need to hire transportation. We need that to be solid, especially with so much money dropping. The STPG comes through every year. It's solid. We could be applying for planning grant for, yeah.
Well, this is a big part of, too, why the accounting at Rhodes is so important, and that we get them some help to get their accounting up to speed. I know part of the problem with getting our small business entity designation through the state was because of our financials and not being up to speed there. Okay. So that is kind of a part of that, and hopefully that will help.
Okay. Yeah, I knew we were out of compliance with Wally doing what he was doing in that program. But, if, you know, there's a lot of tribal members that could help and want to help too. So, you know, I always appreciate everything I learned from the tribe. I remember when I grew up, each council member would have a board of projects that they were working on and things, you know, and now they're on their phone. Maybe we should have a phone box over there. But just things, times have changed. I get it. But I always want the tribe to prosper. I'm not picking. I'm not, you know, I always want to help where I can.
All right. All right, we'll go to Aaron, and then we got to go to Mike Orchid. But go ahead there, Aaron.
Aaron Pohl.
Okay, sorry about that, Mike. I'll be short and sweet. So I just want to make everybody know that I've been unjustly fired. I want to address, first of all, not necessarily the council, but the new forest manager that when I was working for forestry, I was unjustly fired. I still don't know why I was fired. Other than the reason was that I refused to take a drug test. And as I know, the policy says that if you refuse, it's just like a dirty test. And then you go through the counseling or whatever, and then you go back to work after a month. That process never happened with me. And I just got put on the chopping block for, I don't know why. I just got off of a broken leg, and I was in shape just like I am now. I'm 183 pounds and fit. I don't see why they would want to fire me. It's kind of a strange thing. And then, that's kind of like a, you know, a move forward we could do in the chain of the command from forestry, maybe something that you guys can talk about, because that's what happened. It should have stopped at right at the point where I've never had a dirty pee test or urine analysis for the Hoopa Valley Tribe or anywhere.
Well, I would encourage you to keep applying for jobs with the tribe, Aaron.
I have, definitely. Yeah, but my passion is in historic preservation, and I'm quite well at it. And there's and that kind of rolls into my next question, and just a question we could think about and ponder as we, you know, live our lives. High dance people are given responsibility to dance at the ceremonial sites up and down the place where the creator hand printed each of the five High Dance tribes, seven geographical places. And so I think it would be a good move for us in the future to be a fully sovereign, confederated High Dance of Northern California. So, and we can take models from like the Cherokee Nation and on the East Coast, Carolinas. Northern Carolina has confederated Cherokee tribes there. We can take that model. And then the biggest thing that we need to do is, you know, it's hard to coordinate all the stuff that we have. I think we could do better if we had a justice system that represents our people. Because when I went out, I got thrown in, never had any trouble with the law all my life. And I went to jail for 3 months. And the people who I was going to be my peers to look at me and judge me, they look at me as an Indian, and they, I would have lost anything. And I probably would have ended with three felonies and never got in trouble my whole life. So,
okay, Aaron, we're going to have to move on.
No, sir. You're going to listen to me until I'm done.
We have a five-minute limit. Okay, we asked for everybody.
Okay, well, 5 minutes. I never heard anybody set the clock. Did we?
We're getting into the personal issues. It's a tribal meeting.
Just really quick, summary, really quick. Okay, so this is it. So please excuse me. All right. Just please back off. Hold on. So look, High Dance. Let me get back on that. So that's what happened. I'm not pointing fingers, but I have to say this because I was unjustly dealt with. So that has to do with my feelings. I thought about what I needed to do, so I needed to confess this publicly that I was unjustly dealt with. Okay? And Confederated Tribes is a must. We got to separate ourselves from the United States of America. So smoke on it. Think about it. It's definitely a better option. I have by, it should be, let's see, May, June. I should have like a draft of what we'd have, steps we'd have to do in order to take that action. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. All right, before we go to Mike, we got one last ticket here, $100 gift card for Hoopa Grocery Store. 744-067. 744-067. There it is, Rhonda. She's been wanting it. All right, let's go to Mike Orkett. Come on, Mike.
I've been going to a lot of meetings here for a lot of years, and I want to do a sound check because it's pretty hard to hear, and I'm going to try to speak as loud and clearly as I can. And I was going to ask, thank the audience for staying here for sure, and try to give a short one or a long one, whatever you guys want to do. Darcy says short, so. Because I was going to do my practice for my HR, but I'll do one part of the leadership training that we've been having. And I'm going to start by saying I also want to acknowledge the language here and culture here in Hoopa, and I'm going to try to use my words, Hoopa words here. Willie de Quinta Ante. My name is Mike Orkett. If anybody doesn't know me, my mom was Dorothy Moon Lincoln. My dad was Lawrence Dud Orkett. Pleasure to be here this morning, this afternoon. Boy, it's been a long week here. And I wanted to tell a joke, though, hopefully at your indulgence late in the day. I was coming back, one of the names of the lawyers that Joe Davis named there is a guy that's working for the Interior Department. He's worked for the Hoopa Valley Tribe since 1991, and I was coming back and briefing. I have long conversations on the road back from Sacramento. And so I pulled into, the wife said, pull into, which is the ice cream place there, anyway, around Clear Lake there. And so I said, well, Joe, I got to order my ice cream there. And I ordered it, and I go, boy, it was a two-scooper with a cone, and it was $9.80-something cents. And I joked, this is a joke part of it. I said, boy, they must have put Trump's tariffs on this one. And I would say, and my lawyer just told me, the Supreme Court struck down a lot of those tariffs, so hopefully ice cream prices will go down. So, and I also wanted to start by saying a couple of other things, administrative mainly. We recently had an employee that retired over 40-plus years, Clyde Matilton Jr. We had a going-away party for him at Blue Lake Casino. I would like to acknowledge that. He's been there a long time, strong proponent of, you know, hiring tribal members. He started about the same time I did, and he retired before I did, but hopefully some of the things I'm going to be talking about, we're going to get some of those things done, hopefully. We also, just an announcement, we have an opening there for an administrative assistant there, or clerical assistant, so that's out for advertisement. If anybody knows anybody, please feel free to advertise. And also, something that came up at the recent council meeting about education. I wanted to hit on one thing as far as our department and where we kind of come together. We have goals, objectives, mission statements, and from a long time, through the course of my career, we've supported tribal member education. We presently have tribal members that have already gotten degrees. They're now receiving proper experience. Scotty Searle and Lindsay Flores, both are graduates, and they're working in our program. We also are funding Robert Baldy Jr. He's just started into Cal Poly Humboldt. Yeah, there you go. Hey, they stayed. My relative's back there. Yay, thank you. So anyway, the point of that all is, for a long time, our technicians are mainly tribal members. Our staff that wants to go to school, we've already funded people to go to school, continue to do that and support education. And I think what I wanted to leave in part on you there is the success of our program, hopefully it's successful, is viewed as being successful for this tribe, is that it wouldn't work if it wasn't for our tribal members. I have guys that came out of high school that just got promoted to some positions, really key positions. Very, very smart guys. When we have guys come out of Humboldt State, out of Cal Poly Humboldt now, they teach them how to identify fish. So we have a real good working group there. And so I'll get into the substance of my report there. Sorry for that one. I was doing some training there, on-the-job training. So we do have a report out there. I want to report on a couple of things that are really kind of important. One of them is the Supply Creek restoration project is underway. We hope to get that completed. There's been some bumps in the roads and some delays with that, and we really want to get that done. And so the phases that we can construct before the sanitation site is mitigated and removed will be underway and hopefully completed. The fishery, I think it's important. You know, everybody reads the internet these days. Klamath. On the climate side, I'll say it in a way that I understand it. Falchenik salmon that used to go to Iron Gate Hatchery, there was a long time of thinking that they couldn't get through this, what's called the Straits, Lake Iwana, that's what it's called, and then through the lake, Upper Klamath Lake. I think the estimate is something on the words of 13,000 Falchenik spawned all the way up into the headwaters of the Klamath River, all the way up into the Sprague River. We have friends up there, and there's a lady there that there was fish spawning in her backyard right off her porch there on the Williamson River. So that's a project and proposed action that we're dam removal that is a work in progress and something that we're going to keep taking a look at. But as far as the numbers go, this past year, They predicted 19,000. They got a linnet share, so a natural fish, which is any fish that spawns outside the hatchery, estimated to be 19,000 natural spawners. We got almost 20,000 additional fish this year, which is really, really good. A large percentage of the our staff, I should mention, our staff does all the data collection, the scale analysis, all of that. And HOOPA, I'll go as far as to say the HOOPA Valley Tribe are rolling all of that stuff. It is there, the stock projections, the weir counts, the data information collection. It wasn't for HOOPA, that information wouldn't even be available. And we've really strived, and it's actually a part of our litigation with the Bureau of Reclamation presently. So that data and information, about 20,000 over, a large, one really, really good sign for our fishery is the age two fish, relative survival of those predicts ocean populations. And so we're going to have a the Trinity side was way up in contrast to the Klamath. And that's another thing I can talk all day long on another subject, but we're trying to separate out the Trinity in terms of a management so we can manage it separately and on a river-by-river, run-by-run basis. It means kind of buzzwords there, but it means that when fish are caught in the ocean or down below us, that they're accounting for those numbers in a real-time management way that we know how many of them are coming to our reservation and are available for harvest. And so I'll say one thing, a metric that people always look at is, well, how many fish did HOOPA catch? How many did everybody else catch? The Yurok tribe reported about 1,300 fish. The HOOPA Valley tribe announced we were going to take 1,250. We took about close to about 2,300 adult false Chinook salmon. So if you look at the 80-20, because that's another that buzzed, we had an 80-20 earlier here, but the 80-20 in terms of fish allocation is Yurok will announce we're taking 80% of the fall run and 20% is available for HOOPA. That's about a 65% for HOOPA take. And I will say this, and I'll maybe talk offline to anybody that wants to talk about it. The HOOPA Valley Tribe in 2017, representation, some of the folks at this table, some of the folks in the audience, really drove that home. It's a sovereign authority of the Tribal Council to set harvest conservation standards, and the PFMC that sets ocean seasons will readily tell you that. So that's one thing. And in the interest of time, I will talk a little bit about the subject the chairman had raised. We have strongly advocated for, we're in a litigation lawsuit, and you say, okay, what is that going to get you? We're coming up on 6 years when the HOOPA Valley Tribes filed our lawsuit in August of 2020. We negotiated for a year and a half with the federal government under the Biden administration, under a native, I'll add it, not trying to be derogatory or in a demeaning manner. It was a native secretary, it was a native solicitor in the federal government, and we couldn't even get even a meeting with those people. And so we are waiting now for a court decision. But in the interim, most everybody that's been involved, the council, some of the council here at the table today have been involved in those negotiations. 95 to 98% of the issues could be resolved administratively. So I strongly advocated that we reestablish our position in Washington, D.C., and Spirit Rock has been mentioned a couple times, is a LLC lobbying firm that's been hired. Started the first of the year, and we're actively working on what Joe's talking about. And locally, our hope is that we resolve a lot of these longstanding issues that have been just there forever. One of them that implicates our fishing or economic ties to the water supplies and the Trinity River here is what's called the so-called proviso. 250,000 acre feet that Humboldt County has a 1959 contract with the Bureau of Reclamation. I'm going to tell the truth in the story. I'm bound to tell truth here. Since the 2002 fish kill, the ones that have advocated long, hard, and rigorously to get additional water so we wouldn't have a large-scale fish kill on the Klamath River was the HOOPA Valley Tribe. We went into 2014 and 2015 in litigation. We even called on that water to be used. And the federal government, despite what we thought they were going to do, they said, well, you have water here secured already. In addition to that water supply, we're going to release the water because the 1955 legislation says preserve and propagate the fishery. So they can call on any time additional water above and beyond what we're already allocated. And so at that point in time, the litigation on that water supply ended, and it's still there. And so we still kept going hoopla. In 2014, there's a legal opinion. Some people are good at some really bright people in the room today. Go on the internet and look at Hillary Tompkins' 2014 legal opinion. It separated out, distinctly acknowledged that there's a Humboldt County right to that water. And yet, what a solicitor, depending on what federal bureaucrat you talk to, is that's the law of the land.